greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage again. That's georgegordon.org or georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay tuned for tonight's special report on Joshua's Long Day when we come back. In over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We've been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions in our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers who manage our financial affairs, and doctors who manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers who direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? Remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can call and order yours right here at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been discussing this phenomenon called Joshua's Long Day. Skeptics don't believe in raising people from the dead, or they don't believe that lions can eat bones. They discount the three Hebrews in the fiery furnace, Joshua's long day, the walls of Jericho, and the parting of the Red Sea. These are miracles. Well, we call them miracles. I think that if somebody from the Civil War era, or from the Revolutionary War period, or from the Middle Ages saw a 747 flying through the air, they would call that a miracle, or witchcraft. Today, we look at the airplane flying through the air, and we don't see that as any particular miracle. I think if you took a look at television, radio, those are miracles. Well, actually, they're just the utilization of known laws. There are certain laws, there are certain cause and effect relationships that go on in our physical world, in our physical universe, and as we progress through time, we learn more and more. We're smarter today, technologically further advanced today than we were 100, 200, or 500, or 1,000 years ago. But we don't call airplanes, radio, and television miracles, but yet they are pretty miraculous. So when somebody comes along and he's able to do something, fly an airplane, for instance, or drive an automobile, or make steel float on the water, you know, to a savage, to an illiterate, to someone who's ignorant, he looks at that and says, oh my God, that's a miracle. This guy must be a god. I imagine when the Indians first saw those thunder sticks here in the New World, you know, they'd been used to bows and arrows and spears and clubs, and all of a sudden here comes these Spaniards with thunder sticks, and they can kill people without even touching them. Hell, you could be out there 100 feet or 100 yards and kill a man with a thunder stick. That was a miracle. You know, today we don't look upon that as being a miracle. But this is something that is pretty spectacular when you can stop the world from moving in its orbit. I mean, if you can stop the world for a day, to stop it from spinning, it's still in its orbit. He never said that he stopped it in its orbit. He said he stopped it from spinning for about a whole day. Now, that's going to require some real talent. Now, if we knew how to do that, and if we could do that today, we wouldn't call that a miracle. It would be the harnessing of a law. So to say that it's impossible to stop the world on its axis is just savagery in the Aitri rainforest and ignorance, because we don't know how to do that yet. Now, I'm not suggesting that man is about on the verge of learning how to stop the world from spinning. I'm just suggesting to you that the fact that here's a God who says, I not only can stop the world from spinning, I can do all kinds of neat stuff. You know, like I can part the water. Now, that's quite a trick. Parting the Red Sea, that was a pretty good trick. But is it a miracle, or is it law that this God knows about and knows how to use and control, like we know how to use and control airplanes, radio and television, and we don't call those miracles any longer. They were a miracle at the time. They were great wonders. But, you know, once we've been able to master that, we don't continue on saying, "Woo, look at this radio broadcaster. You know, he's a god because he can speak to us from Washington, D.C. We look at that more pragmatically today. Well, Professor Totten went through seven sources of proof, or seven places, seven ways that you could prove Joshua's long day. And here's what they are if you want to write them down. First of all is the Bible. He looked at the biblical record. It's an ancient document, and he said, I think this ancient document is telling us a true story. When we pick up a history book and we read about the Battle of Gettysburg and Pickett's charge, we don't sit there and say, well, this book is filled with lies. There's no place called Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and this battle over here is crazy. We don't believe a word of it. Or it's a myth which was invented to aggrandize Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you know, come on, guys. We're a little smarter than that, aren't we? The second is history. History, you know, is written about our Civil War, not just from our perspective, but you could go to Germany. And German history books will have something to say about the American Civil War. There are other people in the world that were alive at that time, and they too wrote about our Civil War. Then there's chronology. There are people called chronologists who keep track of dates and times and events. Abraham Lincoln was president at this time, and certain events transpired from 1860 to 1865. Then there's astronomy. And astronomy is a timekeeping methodology that we use. We use it today. And there are eclipses of the sun and the moon that occur at specific times, and they're predictable in the future, and you can go back in the past and identify when they occurred. And then there are equinoxes, and these equinoxes occur twice a year, you know, in the spring and in the fall. Actually, there's four of these dates. And an equinox is simply the length of a day. The longest day of the year is about June 21st, and the shortest is December 21st. And in the spring, on March 21st and on September 21st, the days are of equal length, 12 hours day, 12 hours night. We call those equinoxes. And then we have the almanac, which keeps track of these events, these chronologies and astronomies and eclipses and so on. And so Professor Totten here in his book called Joshua's Long Day gets into such thing as corroborated by eclipses. So the Bible and history and chronology, astronomy, the equinoxes and the almanac are also verified by these eclipses. Let's take a look at this. He says, but to return again to the discussion of Joshua's long day and of the true chronology thence resulting, of course, the announcement of this calculation has awakened criticism and dispute. For instance, it has been pertinently asked why, if this line of time is now at last so accurately defined, does not the professor make it pass through some well-known date, or better yet, string an eclipse or so upon it, so that we who prefer to feel our way carefully backward from the present, rather than boldly start out from Adam's era of paradise, may at least have some one of these lunation milestones marked with its true and intelligible elements. Until this is satisfactorily done, we shall continue to be in doubt as to whether even this new moon conjunction, to say nothing of its extra astronomical pretensions, is a fake or a fact. Well, the position taken by this correspondent is the natural, modern, and scientific one, and I should be certainly in the vocative if I could not furnish astronomical waymarks backward from the present so well as forward from creation's dawn, whereby to verify my work. It is as manifest to me as it can be to a practical astronomer that if my line of lunations is correct, I should be able to identify upon it some of the eclipses of the past. This is exactly what I can do, and, in fact, what I have already done in order to verify my calculations to my own satisfaction, and with this result. That the line being correct, it serves to identify every eclipse, both of the sun and the moon, that has ever occurred, from the dawn of time, or ever can occur so long as the solar system obeys the laws that now govern it. Now, this is not an extraordinary claim, as it may seem. All solar eclipses must occur at new moon, and all lunar eclipses occur at full moon. There are at a maximum of 70 possible eclipses in a team or sequence of 18 years and 10 days, after which they repeat in exactly the same sequence, and they move down the ages as unerring signposts. These signposts are planted by the moon in her lunations, and if we have her line correctly, we can certainly identify not only any eclipse of history, but all the rest, whether recorded or not. Now, to identify a single eclipse recorded some years ago is to demonstrate to a practical astronomer that the line is right, and this I shall proceed to do. Let us therefore refer to my original announcement made in the New Haven Register of June 21st, 1890. But by printer's mishap, somewhat disarranged. The proper announcement was that 802 lunar years and two lunations ago, Joshua's Beth Horon conjunction was repeated. For example, it reoccurred in due mathematical relation to the zenith of the same place. All right, I'm going to pause right here. Remember I told you a couple days ago about a gearbox and that gearbox, when you spin that input shaft, that gear that it's turning is turning another gear, which in turn turns another gear, and so on down the line. If you put dots on every one of those gears and you turn at one revolution, all of the gears and all of the dots are going to be all over the place. As you continue to turn those gears, at some point, they will all come back into alignment. At some point. I don't know if it's 50 revolutions, 500 revolutions, or 5,000 revolutions. But that's exactly the way that our solar system works. And now Totten took on the skeptics and he said, okay, let's take a look at eclipses. And he said, this conjunction of the moon being over this Gunsight Pass in Ajalon and the sun being at its zenith at high noon, that occurred, and it occurs recurringly every, see how many years did he say that was? Every 802 years and two lunations. So as already noted, one must always speak advisedly as to repetitions and with a full knowledge that they are merely approximations at best and are of value to almanac makers only according to their degree. Our modern almanac makers are generally content with accuracy to days or hours, or at most to minutes, very rarely to seconds. But the universe exhausts the very ultimate. Now, the reconjunction to which I then referred, aside from any of its merely local or Beth Horon concomitants, to which, however, it was duly and mathematically related, took place upon March 29th, 1112 A.D., and as I announced in the New Haven Register of July 2nd, 1890, it was then additionally marked by a solar eclipse, to wit, number 52 of the regular team. There was no eclipse, but simply a conjunction upon the day of Beth Horon in 1112 A.D. The eclipse referred to was brought about by the fullness of other cycles. Now, this eclipse of March 29th, 1112 A.D. was followed the next month, April the 13th, by a lunar eclipse number 53. And at autumnal equinox of that year, September 22nd, the sun was again eclipsed, the first points of Libra number 54, and this latter eclipse was followed by the next month, October the 6th, by another lunar eclipse, number 55, and on March 18, 1113 AD, exactly 12 lunations or one full lunar year after the one with which we started, at the 19th hour of the day, a full solar eclipse, number 56, occurred at Jerusalem, and was then and there recorded, as will be found by consulting the records of eclipses. Beth Horon, Ajalon, and Gibeon are but a few miles northwest of Jerusalem, and an eclipse which involved one would certainly have encompassed the others. This was in the reign of Henry I of England and of Baldwin I of the Latin kingdom of Jerusalem. Here, then, we have tied ourselves to an eclipse which is actually recorded and have thus verified the unerring accuracy of our line of time. So let me here state further that this latter eclipse, number 56, will be repeated on April the 16th, 1893 A.D., as a necessary resultant of the very same celestial mechanism, and may be predicted far more certainly than we can count upon the future chimes of any earthly chronometer. Upon that day the sun will set, eclipsed at Jerusalem. Now, to return now to our eclipse number 52, which we stated to have specially marked the repetition of the Beth-Horon conjunction of Joshua's day, the distance apart of these two new moons is exactly 31,604 lunations, or 2,555 and one-quarter solar years. And the first one, or Joshua's, actually occurred in the year 2555 AM at its winter solstice. But, as it is fairly demanded that the trace shall be backward from the present rather than forward from the origin of time, which is under dispute, let us take the new moon of this present month, now shining and full today, Wednesday, July 2nd, 1890, which, by the way, is the central day of the current solar year, as we moderns fix it, in the AD system, and which may be still further anchored to the rigid facts of the solar system by noting that this fullness occurs with the sun in apogee and the moon in perigee. It is thus manifest that we could not have a better nor more remarkable lunation from which to reverse our cycles and feel backward to that far greater one which is the object of our studies on Joshua's long day. This modern lunation under consideration was renewed on June 17, 1890, reckoning then from it 3,435 lunar years and 10 lunations in the past, marks the conjunction of Joshua's long day. In other words, the time backward is 41,230 lunations, no more and no less, and they pass through every eclipse, both in history and out of history, because they start with the very last eclipse of history, to wit, the annular one of the sun, which occurred on this very June 17, 1890, which is our starting point. And it passes through the group mentioned in 1112 and 1113 AD. In the humble opinion of this writer, this calculation has come to stay and someday to be recognized at its full and intrinsic value, and he is confident that if he could calculate the trajectory of a human projectile as unerringly as he can rely on the motions of those that Jehovah has placed in the heavens for signs and for seasons, insofar as Adam's race is concerned, he would feel very little anxiety for America in time of foreign war, even if he had to fight her battles single-handedly. In the meantime, it may be maintained that while the Bible needs no human bolstering to support its infinite accuracy, nevertheless, we are constrained to believe that the human understanding itself does need such helps as this and similar calculations in order to force it back upon the sometime inevitable plane of implicit faith. So there's a story now on, I'll put a little mark here on eclipses. And he says, now they're also verified by the equinoxes, as one among several other independent verifications of this calculation, it is to be noted that the autumnal equinox last year, 1889, was the 5,888th since creation, and that it occurred upon the 2,150,548th day of the world, to wit, upon Sunday, September the 22nd, 1889, as we know from the government statistics of that year, and which Sunday, in spite of parliamentary enactments as to Greenwich Mean Noon Time, did not really commence until its own modern sundown had been duly recorded by nature at the far-off eastern primary meridian. The ephemeris time of this autumnal equinox was circa 8H45M, that's 8 hours and 45 minutes after Greenwich Mean Noon of that modern Sunday, which is set back from the ancient origin of day by just 6 hours. Thus, the true time was 2 hours and 45 minutes after the Greenwich Mean Sunset beginning of this particular Sunday, or 9 hours, 37 minutes, 31 seconds, after its sunset commencement at the most ancient primary meridian. Nevertheless, it can come so by no possible mathematics without the interpolation or intercalation of exactly 24 hours. This intercalation is demanded by the 23 and one-third hours, about a whole day, which compassed the stoppage of relative motion upon Joshua's Tuesday, Wednesday, together with Hezekiah's 40 minutes, or two-thirds of a single hour, for example, 10 degrees backwards of the sun's motion, by which the calendar was finally set in absolute order. Now, all of this is proved by the simple inspection and comparison of the two following equations. And he cites these two equations, which There's no point in me broadcasting over the air because I'm not sure that anybody listening to me could grasp it anyway, but it's on page 60. So if you want the calculations, then what do they call these equations, send me a stamp self-addressed envelope and I'll photocopy them for you and send them to you. It's page 60 of the book, and when you write to me, a lot of times this will happen. And so let me caution you right here as I make my famous mark in the margin. 3 months from now, somebody is going to send me a letter and say, yeah, Gordon, send me those calculations on the equations of Joshua's long day. And my wife is going to say, I got an email today, and this guy wants these calculations. And it may be 3 months or 3 years from now, because these broadcasts are archived, and somebody somewhere is going to say, hey, send them to me. I can't remember page 60 of a book, Joshua's Long Day, 3 years from now. Hell, I'll be lucky if I can remember it until it's past breakfast. So be good enough, would you not, to cite the book, Joshua's Long Day, page 60, has equations. Send those to me. Then, with that much information, I can say, aha, if I could find a book somewhere here in my library called Joshua's Long Day, turn to page 60, and photocopy that for this good fellow, I could probably accomplish that. You'd be amazed at how many times people will send me a letter and say, you said on the air, what book, what page, prove that, and blah, blah, blah. And boys and girls, honest to God, my memory is pretty good, but it's not that good. He goes on to say, in which latter equation, the ninth hour, 37 minutes, 31 seconds, fall where they actually came as at creation, namely, upon the requisite Sunday, or a first day of the week, September the 22nd, 1889. Now, this is the dictum of the modern ephemeris, and it is tied to every chronological element in the whole solar system, although the latter consists of more than 250 intimately interlaced cycle-making orbs, not one of which can be impugned without the condemnation of all the rest. Now, in the foregoing equations, Y is the mean solar year value and cannot now be altered 1 second, plus or minus, from 365 degrees, 5 hours, 48 minutes, and then he's got 50, 53, and 60 with some little thingies on them that I don't grasp. While as to the number of years involved, the rigid work of the British Chronological Society has demonstrated by the verification of all the eclipses and transits, both in and out of history, that the number of years spanned from the dawn of Genesis to our September the 22nd, 1889, is no more and no less than 5,888 of mean astronomical duration. And he's got an asterisk, says Vite Appendix D. Let me whip back here to Appendix D, which is this chart, which is so far beyond me, boys and girls, that it's like he's casting pearls before swine. Here's Appendix F, Appendix D. This is stand by now as I flip through here. Appendix D, he's got quite a little story here on changes in the times and seasons. And he talks about the Romans changed the beginning of the year from September to March. And he gets into these various incendiary calendars over here that, you know, you got to be into this pretty hot and heavy to make any sense of it. I want to point out something here, though, while I'm thinking about it. You ever heard the story of Piltdown Man? Piltdown Man. Now, back in about the 1920s, sometime around World War I, some English guy went out and he took some bones and he went out and buried them. Then he went out, you know, a month or two later and he discovered these bones and he says, oh my God, I have found the earliest man at the dawn of history. And so, you know, a bunch of other scientists, they went out there and they said, oh, my God, look at this. It reminded me of the emperor's new clothes. And they said, oh, my God, Professor so-and-so over here, he has found the earliest human. And they dug up some more bones, and as time went on, they dug up some more bones. And pretty soon, oh, from about World War I to about, you know, 1950, this Piltdown man over here, he was the standard of evolutionary science. And then they found out that it was a fraud. They found out it was a hoax. And then they published a little bit on it, and they said, well, this Piltdown man is a hoax. And then it just died out. Died out. Nothing more was ever said about it. When you listen to Piltdown man, you mentioned that to somebody. You ever heard of Piltdown man? Oh, yeah, I think I've heard of that. Now, you'd think that if there was a hoax, you know, you can rest assured that if this guy, Totten, was perpetrating a hoax, that these evolutionists would be touting this from the top of the Empire State Building, day in and day out, the Professor Totten hoax. Yeah, the Totten hoax. Now, what they have to do is they have to shut up. So they don't tell you anything about this guy, Totten. I looked for over 20 years to find this treatise. I couldn't find it anywhere. And then one day, just out of the blue, I don't even remember now how I got in contact with this guy, Howard Rand, probably some student of mine, probably said, why don't you call this guy and see if he knows anything about Totten? And lo and behold, yeah, he did know. And he had the document. Now, these professors, they write treatises. This could have been his PhD treatise or something. I don't know. I don't know what caused him to write this. Maybe he's just religious. I don't know. But I'll guarantee you this, that if this wasn't true, that every mouth of infidelity would be screaming from the top of every tall building in the United States, if not the world, about this hoax. When these hoaxes are discovered in evolutionary circles, they just quietly bury them. You never hear about them again. You can look them up in the scientific literature. This theory has been discarded. Or it's no longer as popular as it used to be. Instead of coming right out and saying, well, there were a bunch of damn liars that were trying to perpetrate this fraud on us. It's a theory that has less veracity today than it had in the past. They put a little spin on it. Hang on a second, and I'll be right back with more on Joshua's Long Day after I remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, and civil rights, along with biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we use or cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily 100% endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network, or of our local radio stations. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. We are reviewing these seven proofs. The Bible says it, history corroborates it, chronology verifies it, astronomy proves it, eclipses, equinoxes, and the almanac corroborate it. Now he goes on to say, this is the dictum, talking about equinoxes now. This is the dictum of the modern ephemeris, and it's tied to every chronological element in the whole solar system, although the latter consists of more than 250 intimately interlaced cycle-making orbs, not one of which can be impugned without the condemnation of all of the rest. All right, now let's take a look at the shadow on the dial of Ahaz. It is the firm conviction of this writer, fully borne out by certain conditions impressed upon the verification of these events as part of one grand entirety, that the actual duration of the stoppage of relative motion in Joshua's day was exactly 23 1/3 hours, and that to avoid calendric confusion, the high priest or official timekeeper naturally authorized the intercalation of a full day, 24 hours, at the time of the Beth Horon occurrence. That, nevertheless, it was always thereafter a matter of the most careful record that this intercalation was 40 minutes in excess of the truth. This knowledge must have descended to the days of Hezekiah and Isaiah, the latter of whom, probably fully informed thereon, made double purpose in his latter and equally extraordinary request that this remaining part of the missing hour might be, then and there, made up and the calendar thus made absolutely correct. For while ninths of time have not escaped me in this verification, I can find no indication of any calendric change as incident upon Hezekiah's request. Nevertheless, the totality of time between the primeval autumnal conjunction in Eden and the 72,834th, which occurred on June 17, 1890, demands exactly 24 hours interpolation or intercalation for the two events. All this is also borne out by a fair and critical examination of the texts concerned. When we compare 2 Kings 20, verses 1 through 11, with Isaiah 38, 2 Chronicles 32, verse 24, and Joshua 10, verse 13, Hezekiah ascended the throne at the end of 3,278 years A.M., and he died at the end of 3,307 years A.M., having reigned exactly 29 years, the last 15 years being from equinox to equinox. The dial incident occurred at the beginning or autumnal equinox of the solar year, 3293 A.M., for example, just 15 exact solar years before his death. Isaiah's visit to him was upon Wednesday, the 1,202,744th day of the world, and this was the 18th day of the first civil month of 3293 AM, and at the 18th hour thereof, or at high noon, reckoning from sundown, and the sun went into autumnal equinox. It was at this very moment, and before Isaiah left the sick king's bedside, to which he had just previously returned, as we see in 2 Kings 20, verses 4 and 5, that at the prayer of the prophet, the shadow went back 10 degrees or 40 minutes upon the dial of Ahaz. The sign was thus given at once, and upon the actual solar New Year's Day, and instant, although from the position of the then current year upon the calendar, the event has until now been completely hidden from us moderns. Now there's no reason to doubt that the prodigy was quickly reported to the anxious monarch by the high priest of the day, for this latter, as the official calendar keeper, would at that very moment have been closely watching the shadow in the court without, and would have been so doing entirely unconscious of what was taking place at the same time beside the sick bed in the palace, since he would, by mere virtue of his office, have been necessarily and personally at the dial awaiting the new year instant. And it was at such a moment that Isaiah the prophet cried unto the Eternal, and he brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down in the dial of Ahaz. Now this is God a second time moving the world. In this case, he stopped the world and moved it backwards 10 degrees. Boys and girls, here again. Now, can you stop the world? Well, I don't think you could stop the world instantaneously, but you could decelerate it. And Howard Rand, a little later on here in this same book, his view is that the world turned over 90 degrees on its polar axis. That is, you know, the world spins, if you've got a globe in front of you, the top and bottom of the world are sitting at the north and south poles, roughly. And the world tips a little bit, 23.5 degrees, you know, on its axis. And he said the world kept on spinning on its axis, but like a gyroscope, the world could have turned over on the poles. Well, that might be so. That might be the mechanism by which God did this, and that the world made one complete revolution, or not quite a complete revolution, which would then have left it a little bit more than 23.5 degrees out of, you know, off of its axis, which would have affected the seasons. I don't know whether or not the world flipped over on its axis or not. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't. But in any event, what did God do to stop the moon? You know, oftentimes I think that these dumb human theories and hypotheses that we come up with in order to explain God's mistakes, God's lies, God's, you know, misstatements are worse than the text itself. First of all, he didn't tell us how he did it, but it is certainly within the realm of my limited understanding to imagine the world decelerating like a jet airplane until it stops, and then accelerating until it reaches 1,000 miles an hour again, which is about what the world spins. You know, if it takes 24 hours for a day, and the world is about 24,000 miles in diameter, it takes about 24 hours in a day for the world to spin. Then we come along with a clock, and we divide that into 24 hours, and we call that time. it's kind of arbitrary. The time is really capped, if you think about it, by these planetary motions. We verify our clocks by these planetary motions. Now, the Bible tells us plainly that the world stopped for about a whole day and then started up again, and that the moon did the same thing with it, and that he did two planets at the same time, the world and the moon. And then he did it twice. Not once, but he did it twice. He did it with Joshua, and then he did it for 40 minutes with Hezekiah. And then he goes on in the book of Amos, a little prophetic book here in the back of the Old Testament, he says he's going to do it again. There's one more of these world-stopping events that he says is going to occur yet in the future. Now, this guy is talking like he's a real God and knows what he's doing and how to do it. The significance of these closely related circumstances is not to be underrated, nor should we lose sight of the fact that we're now, for the first time, sufficiently informed upon them to properly understand the rationale of what occurred upon this momentous day. The equinox of the year in question was a remarkable one at Jerusalem just because it occurred at local high noon. The normal advent of this particular equinox was undoubtedly foreknown as an astronomical event and eagerly anticipated by those skillful stargazers. The preparations for its accurate observation were made beforehand, as certainly as in modern days they would have been to watch a pre-calculated transit of Venus. Moreover, the machinery for all of this observation already existed in a most elaborate form. Ahaz, more than any of the kings of Judah, had turned his attention to Sabaism, or star worship, as we see in 2 Chronicles 28, and had erected its astrological altars throughout the city of his fathers, and he had copied the design of one in particular, whose steps formed the famous dial, from an original seen by him in Damascus, where he went to meet Tiglath-Pileser in 2 Kings 16, and this altar was placed right in the center of the temple area. Not only, therefore, was it conveniently located for observation, but from that area the access into the king's palace was direct. Now we can thus easily picture to ourselves the two groups who were chiefly concerned in the event, the high priest with his attendants carefully watching the shadow as it moved slowly towards the noon mark, and the king dying from a carbuncle in its last stages, doubtfully listening to Isaiah as he promised him so speedy a recovery that in 3 days he could go out and pay his vows in person at the altar. These circumstances also lend peculiar light to the sign that the prophet then and there suggested in verification of his message. Now, what was going on without in the temple court was a matter of general information. The king, of course, knew about it. Isaiah knew it. All Jerusalem knew it. And this very fact may have suggested to Isaiah the peculiar fitness of this particular sign under the circumstances. It was already noon, and the shadow was probably just about to fall into coincidence with the meridian. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or go back 10 degrees? Now ask the prophet. And Hezekiah answered, it is an easy thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees, for example, to pursue its course. No, but let the shadow turn backwards 10 degrees. So in the court, without the intent group were just about to announce the meridional coincidence, when lo and behold, the shadow suddenly reverses its easy motion, and an unexpected and unprecedented prodigy occurs. The shadow moves suddenly and steadily backward over a large section of the dial and stands at the 20-minute mark. 40 minutes yet to noon. There is no doubting the evidence of one's own senses. And chief among those senses who were amazed stood the high priest himself. Now the surprise and the consternation of this functionary can be judged of in a small degree by the sense of awe that with which the present discovery of this so unlooked for accuracy and the fitness of the several phases of the incident must strike the modern mind. Well, let's think about it for a second. You're sitting here watching the clock, and the clock turns backward 40 minutes. I've got one of those clocks here. It's what they call an atomic self-setting clock, and it sets here in my kitchen. And let's suppose that the battery goes dead, and so you put a new battery in it. Well, about, I don't know if it's every hour or every so often, this location called Isabella, Missouri, passes under some satellite. And you can be sitting here at the table, and all of a sudden, my clock over there just starts going around and around and around it goes. And pretty soon, at exactly 9:01 or 9:02, it stops. Whichever the exact time is. I've got two of those clocks up there, so I can turn around and look at the other one. And then compare the two of them, and the one that has just reset itself is exactly on time compared to the other one. Now, you know, think about this. You're sitting here watching the sundial. You're an official chronometer reader or a timekeeper, and the equinox is about to occur. You know, you might be sitting there saying, well, what in the hell is this guy? You mean they were sitting over here watching the sundial 24 hours a day? No, only 12, because 12 hours is dark, and the sundial doesn't work in the dark. But, you know, 12 hours a day, was there somebody there? Probably not. Probably not. And this sundial of Ahaz over here is big. It is built right into the building. The building itself is the sundial. The steps. You know, you're standing on the steps, and you walk up the steps. I mean, this thing is humongous. And the equinox is about to occur. So you can just about bet that these guys, all these astronomers of the day, are standing around here waiting for this big event to transpire. It's kind of like, you know, televised coverage of an eclipse. And, you know, they'll get on the air, and they'll say, okay, now the eclipse is just beginning, and they'll show you a picture of the sun. Here it is, and the shadow is just starting to move across it, and then pretty soon they take you to Africa, and they say, gee, look at the shadow starting to appear here in Nairobi, Kenya. And then they'll flip over here to the correspondent. Well, this is Joe Finkelstein reporting to you from Nairobi, Kenya, and here is the shadow as it's beginning to move across Jones and 42nd Street in beautiful downtown Nairobi. You know, he gives you an eyeball description here of what's going on. You can rest assured that somebody was sitting there watching this. And we know that somebody was watching it because they recorded it in their history, in their chronology. They said, hey, Jesus, look at this. This thing turns backward. Now, I haven't personally read the books, but now Totten and Rimmer both report that the Chinese wrote this down. The Egyptians wrote it down. The Greeks wrote it down. That's why we have the history that we can refer to. This isn't piltdown man, boys and girls. This isn't one of those cheap, phony tricks that we get from science. I don't know, everybody seems to be real excited about science. Science is the god of the modern world. God, we worship science. Now, you know, the science god is a pretty good god. I suppose it's as good as Venus and Mars and Neptune. But, hey, listen, they're wrong so much of the time. That's the thing that galls me. I mean, hell, even the Pope, you know, who was infallible, made a mistake from time to time. And sure enough, higher criticism comes along. And they criticize Catholicism and the Pope for saying that the world was flat. or that, you know, the sun revolved around the earth and so on. These scientific errors, and they make fun of it. And they equate those errors with God, and they say, see, God's a dummy. And that's because the champions of God, the clergy, they say the world is round, or they say the world is flat, and that the sun revolves around the earth, when in fact, it's just the opposite. The world is round, and the world is revolving around the sun. And so they say, gee, the Bible is just full of these scientific inaccuracies. No, the Bible isn't full of inaccuracies. It's the clergy, it's the church that's full of inaccuracies, because the church doesn't get its doctrine from the Bible. The church gets its doctrine from its clergy. And I mentioned this before, I'll mention it again. The worst enemies of the Bible, boys and girls, is the church. The church. It's not the longshoreman or the truck driver. Hell, it isn't even the astronomer or the scientist or the evolutionist that's the worst enemy of the Bible. It's the clergy. And that's because philosophy makes a pronouncement, science passes upon it, and then the church verifies it. They're all in agreement, and they're all at variance with the scripture and the scriptural record. And then, when a guy like Rimmer comes along and says, hey, let me see if we can harmonize the scripture with science. The Bible isn't at variance with science. It's the church, it's the clergy that's at variance with science. And then the assumption that the clergy represents the Bible and represents God. The clergy doesn't represent the God of Abraham. They hate him. It's like this guy saying that the people were just real excited about Moses, and they just loved Moses. No, they didn't. They hated Moses. The Israelites despised him. And they said from time to time, let's take him out and stone him. That's what prompted God to say, get out of the way, Moses. I'll just kill all these suckers over here, and I'll raise up a new nation from you. Moses intervened several times. I don't remember, I didn't count them up, but several times, 3 or 4 or 5 times, he intervened and said, wait a minute, God, don't get uppity here, you know, with these people. You know, you've got a contract with them, and we've got to be careful about how we deal with these people, and blah, blah, blah. And he saved our lives several times. Moses was a pretty good old boy, but we didn't think he was a pretty good old boy. All right, that's the shadow going down on the dial of Ahaz over here. And I won't have quite time to finish that. We'll take it up right there. Let me put my famous mark in the margin here on page 65. And in our last program, we'll take up the sundial of Ahaz and the almanac with these various proofs, such as the Bible, history, chronology, astronomy, eclipses, equinoxes, and the almanac, all prove Joshua's long day and the 40 minutes of Hezekiah and the sundial of Ahaz as scientific, astronomical fact, not fiction. All right, I've got to close right about here, so let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.